My name is Paul O'Neill. I come from Belfast in Ireland. I'm an Irish Republican. I'm a former prisoner. I was imprisoned on 5 separate occasions during the 1970s. I was interned without trial. I was also held on remand on 4 occasions, but the state could never provide the evidence to convict me. In 1981, I was arrested and I was charged with evidence provided by a so-called supergrass. His name was Christopher Black. I was sentenced to 17 years imprisonment on the uncorroborated word of Black, and I spent 4.5 years in prison before I was released in the Court of Appeal in 1986. The majority of so-called supergrass cases or show trials occurred during the early 1980s. During this period, there were 29 so-called supergrass cases. 20 of these were directed at Republicans and the remaining 9 against Loyalists. 13 of these cases did not go to trial because the Crown witnesses or supergrasses retracted their statements. However, the supergrass system in Ireland can only properly be understood when viewed within the context of the British state strategy to defeat Irish Republican resistance to British rule in Ireland. The history of the British state in the six county state had consisted of a succession of repressive strategies. For example, during the period 1971 to 1975, several thousand Republicans were interned without trial. The introduction of internment followed a resurgence of armed conflict that had resulted from the repression of the civil rights movement of the late 1960s. However, internment and the accompanying revelations of torture and brutality inflicted on the internees generated fierce opposition. This became politically embarrassing for the British on an international stage. As a result, internment was gradually phased out, but not before it was replaced by a special judicial process for crushing Republican resistance. In propaganda terms, this was designed to create the impression that there was no moral justification for the Republican struggle, and that the political difficulties in Ireland were really a problem of law and order versus criminality. The judicial process that replaced internment became known as the Diplock court system. It was named after its architect, the British judge Lord Diplock. This legal system severely curtailed the rights of the individual, and features of these new political courts included the abolition of juries, long periods on remand without any hope of bail, and numerous convictions based solely on the statement of admission of the accused, which were normally induced by beatings and torture. However, the British eventually had to abandon this policy also. When knowledge about the torture of suspects became widespread, following investigations by Amnesty International, coupled with the statements of police doctors, in 1981, the hunger strike, in which 10 Republicans died, had re-energized and created massive support for the Republican struggle, and exploded the myth that resistance to British rule was a mere criminal conspiracy. In addition, a resurgent IRA were now waging an increasingly effective guerrilla campaign against the British. This meant that the British were now on the defensive, both on the political and military fronts. In order to undermine the Republican struggle and demoralise the Republican and Nationalist community, the British introduced the strategy of recruiting large numbers of so-called supergrasses. Again, the very term supergrass was a falling back on the old tactic of trying to criminalise, as the term supergrass itself has criminal connotations, emanating as it does from the criminal underworld in London. In dealing with the question of why the individual supergrasses did what they did, there is no simple, single answer. Different reasons have been given. These include, for example, that some were already working as informants or agents, that others had simply been broken under interrogation and then became brainwashed by their captors, that others acted purely out of self-interest and self-preservation, or that some were lured by the promise of money and other rewards. In the case of Christopher Black, 38 people, including myself, were convicted on his evidence. In return, Black was granted total immunity from prosecution and was provided with a totally new life and identity outside of Ireland, all costs covered by the state. According to Black, he claimed that when he was under interrogation, the thought of going back to prison was unbearable. So in order to save his own skin, he decided to work with the RUC. Black also claimed to have had a moral conversion from terrorism. Whatever his reasons, however, once he had decided to cooperate with his police interrogators, the self-interest of Black and the RUC now converged. Black's usefulness to the RUC was measured by how many people he could implicate, and the more he could implicate, the greater would be his reward. In any event, he could not be viewed as an independent witness, but as an accomplice of the RUC. During the trial, Black kept up the pretense that he was someone who had undergone a moral conversion. When giving details of the alleged offences, Black always made sure he kept himself on the periphery of events. We, the accused, were always portrayed as a bunch of mindless, evil psychopaths, while Black portrayed himself as someone who was misguided, part saint and part dupe. It was also noticeable from his behaviour, dress and demeanour that he had become almost indistinguishable from his RUC minders. This was hardly surprising, given the fact that Black had remained isolated in RUC custody for over a year before giving his evidence. During this period of isolation, it is obvious that he had become totally dependent on his RUC minders, physically, financially, emotionally, and psychologically. It was also obvious from his performance during the trial that he had been carefully trained and rehearsed on how to give his evidence. Put in a nutshell, Black had become unrecognizable to those who had known him, and he acted in court like a puppet or a robot who was totally under the control of his RUC masters. In addition, new evidence was given by Black that had not appeared in the original depositions. This was allowed by the judge without question. Although Black's evidence was riddled with enough major discrepancies and contradictions to seriously undermine the credibility of his testimony, the judge bent over backwards to find reasons to accept his evidence. The atmosphere throughout the trial was oppressive. RUC men armed with rifles and machine guns remained inside the courtroom, constantly scrutinizing all within. The judge even wore a heavy bulletproof vest under his robes. In reality, the trial was a mere formality, a charade. It had been decided from the outset that we were all to be found guilty, and it was inevitable that we were convicted. The consequences of the so-called Supergrass strategy for the wider Republican community were in the initial stages to cause confusion, major mistrust and suspicion, a certain level of demoralization and anger that people from our own community could stoop so low, particularly in the wake of the heroic self-sacrifice and suffering of the hunger strikers. Ultimately, however, people realized that the Supergrass strategy had not been some spontaneous phenomenon or some mass act of cowardice by demoralized or war-weary individuals. Rather, it was seen for what it was, a deliberate strategy by the state to undermine the morale of the Republican people by trying to show that resistance was futile, as Big Brother would always be watching you from without and within. The whole thrust of that very strategy was to manufacture Supergrasses to that end. Like the other repressive strategies that preceded it, the Supergrass strategy was eventually undermined by a combination of opposition from within Ireland and Britain, which yet again exposed Britain to international attention and threatened its carefully fostered image as a bastion of democracy and fair play. This campaign to undermine the Supergrass strategy was spearheaded by ordinary people on the ground, mostly by our own families. In conclusion, the lesson to be learned from the so-called Supergrass era in Ireland is that the law is regarded by the state as just another weapon in its arsenal. To quote Brigadier Frank Kitson, British strategist in tactics of counterinsurgency, the law should be used as just another weapon in the government's arsenal, and in this case become little more than a propaganda cover for the disposal of unwanted members of the public. The activities of the legal services have to be tied into the war effort in as discreet a way as possible. So in the final analysis, despite what we may think of the individual motivation or the particular mindset of the Supergrass, No matter how much we may hate or loathe them, the supergrasses, their victims, their families, and the communities are all mere pawns in the game to rid the state of its undesirables and political opponents.